So finally, as the Zen points out, if you really want to know what the rules are, you can sit under a tree like Lao Tse did in China, on the plantation or on the estates of a great noble, and just watch. Watch the birds and the flowers and the sunshine. Watch the growing things. Watch the fruits and all the phases of nature. Watch the storms and what they do. You learn a great deal from storms, because the storm frightens us. It seems at the moment to be a terrible thing. It is a worry and an anxiety. And then a few days later, the whole earth has received a baptism from that which seemed to us to be cruel or hard or harsh or dangerous. So everywhere in nature we have, as Lao Tse found, the basis and traces of wisdom. And this is what was brought together in a kind of a mystical way by the Zen folks. Zen is a philosophy of very quiet self-control without effort. It is an effortless effort. It is something that is accomplished by the firmness of relaxation, by refusing to allow the mind to be agitated, to find that we can discipline the mind so that it can do what we want it to do and can be observant of the things we want it to observe, and not constantly leading us from one misery to another. So the Zen people, very quietly, seek to remove from their lives the causes of difficulty, on the grounds that, as in Buddhism, that the attainment of illumination is a personal responsibility, that the individual has to save himself in the last analysis. It sounds a little difficult, but it is also obviously honest, that we should get over, through our own efforts, the things we got into by our own mistakes. So in Zen, everyone has to be his own teacher, his own guide, but he also has to live and be governed by universal cosmotheism for which there can be no exceptions. Therefore, the duty of the mind is to study the symbols of the infinite as they are indicated in the finite. And by doing this, to gradually come to know the will of that which is invisible but inevitable. If the mind is capable of accepting honestly the testimonies of the various faculties, the various perceptions, if it is capable of coordinating them, out of that coordination will come the nearest thing that we have to the symbolic image of divinity. When everything has been reconciled and brought into harmony with universal law, the individual comes as close as anyone can come to the experience of the presence of God. Therefore, this presence of God becomes, in the Buddhist philosophy, the presence of a program, a plan, not a person. It is the realization of the principle of existence. It is the realization that everything that we see around us is a manifestation of one thing. A simple way of finding that is the way Luther Burbank found it. He looked around, he saw all kinds of flowers and plants. If you look at them first, you can say, well, they're all separate flowers and separate plants. They're different shapes, different colors. Some have beautiful aromas and others do not. So that this is a field full of flowers. But Burbank realized that this field full of flowers was simply the way his eyes, the way his mental faculties explored the field. He knew somewhere within himself that there was only one life behind all of these flowers. And if that life failed, they all died. Therefore, they were not separate as they appeared to be. They were merely expressions of one life energy, moving inevitably in space and over the surface of the earth. He realized that the seed and the flower and the plant all were phases of one process of eternal unfoldment in nature. He realized that the great oak tree was hidden in the acorn. He realized that all great things emerge from sources that are invisible, and everything that exists depends for existence upon one life. that the no creature has a life of itself. It's only a differentiation of a universal life. Each thing is part of all other things. Each person is part of humanity. And humanity, as a whole, is part of life in space and as far as we can imagine. Therefore, this one life is the thing that we are trying to understand as much as we can. And we can never see it in its nakedness, because it is beyond any conception or projection that we can imagine. The only way we can find it is through this cosmotheistic approach, in which suddenly we see creation as the body of the creating power. We suddenly see the universe as the eternal. And this eternal, when we view it this way, we must recognize that it has every faculty, power, and attitude conceivable within itself. That there is no part of existence that is beyond this eternal principle. And that this principle is utterly mathematical, utterly realistic, absolutely natural, because it is the creator of nature and manifests through it. When we begin to study these factors a little more clearly, we may gain a little strength to object to the false teachings of our own intellects. We may find that it is easier to believe in good if we begin to recognize that the principle of good is the life principle of everything that exists, and that actually the good is not only a condition, it is an inevitable. And that which exists must ultimately become good, because nothing in nature is lost. So in this type of thing, the Zen man begins to reduce his wants, cultivate a universal quietude, meditate upon the realities of life, and gradually gain the realization of the tremendous power that is within himself. The power which he has never really used, because he has permitted it to become the slave of his mind. That if he wants to be a millionaire, that's important, and for that all other conditions must be sacrificed. If he hates someone, that hatred must be justified and fulfilled by injuring the person who is hated. If the individual is antisocial, he must tear down society. If he is a fanatic in some religion, he must persecute members of other faiths. All these things are mental delusions. They are all the direct result of the individual losing control of his own life and allowing it to pass into the complete control of his mental coordinator. The coordinator can tell him that these armies have righteous causes, that the feud has lasted for ages. Another type is where trying to find out where the land began, who was the first on the land. Now, if you can find that out, it justifies kicking off anyone who's on it now. All these things are schemes and plots and plans which could be solved without bloodshed or without sorrow by simple kindness. But ambitions get in the way of kindness. Ambitions want for themselves. Kindness wants for the common good. So we have to fight this problem. Most of us will not be confronted with the blank necessity of going out and making a militant program out of all this. But we can start as much as possible. When we have a mood come on, let's stop for a minute and say, where does this mood come from? Is this mood a fulfilling, a secret desire of my own? Is it something I have to do simply because I have the mood to do it? If I want to go out and say something unkind about another person, do I have to do it? Well, says the mind, you might as well, because it said this other person said something nasty about you once, and you have a perfect right to get to go out and answer it back. So the individual, well confined, still feeling himself to be a good Christian, goes out and says what he feels like saying and hurts someone else. Now, this is the way we do things. We mean well. We believe an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. We believe if somebody hits us, hit them back. all this type of thing is mind-born. It is part of ages of mental conditioning in which we, from education onward, we train the mind to a defensive, offensive code of life. We constantly show the mind what's wrong with everything. We constantly prove to the mind that in some mysterious way we are better than anyone else. And it goes on and through higher education until finally when we graduate, we not only have lost contact with reality, but in many cases we have simply paralyzed the mind. There's nothing left. The mind is worn out, tired out, and ready to die by the time we're 22 years old. We are educated in all kinds of attitudes that we should never have had. We are forced to assume certain ambitious careers that we were not fitted for. And the whole thing in education today sums up to the concept of success. The one dismal tragedy of life is not to be a success. So in order to be a success in something, we become a universal failure. We lose all contact with values. We try to live in a little world that in itself is passing. We are trying to adjust to a generation, the like of which has never been before and may never be again. We do not have any way of transcending the pressure of an environment. And yet within ourselves there is a power that is stronger than any environment that can ever exist. Because it is the power that is the true environment of life itself. It is the thing that life wants done. And we just haven't the courage or the insight to do it. Of course, education in this field has been seriously neglected. I think every good school should have some kind of a course in it dealing with the contemplative philosophy, with the contemplation of values, entirely apart from the daily processes of making a living. Something should be done to teach the individual something about his own inner life, about the values within him, and that he was not here simply to nurse a carcass. He was here to do something. He was here to release a genius, a power, a skill from within himself. Some may be more equipped than others due to reincarnation, but all in their own way are here to contribute to the common good and not simply to fight the danger of bankruptcy for themselves the rest of their lives. If we had some kind of a basic quietude, I think it would be a great help. In one of the Asiatic countries, Thailand, most young people go into the priesthood. When they graduate from school, many of them become temporarily Buddhist monks or nuns, usually for a year or two. And during that period, they have graduated from school. Now they are there to discover and experience the tranquilities of the spirit. They live an ascetic life for that period of time. It's not permanent, but it's a part of a postgraduate course in being a human being. As a result of being poverty dominated, they have nothing. They can have nothing. The only thing they can accept is a little food in a bowl, and it must be given to them. But this gets through some of this arrogance. It gets through a lot of tension. Also, these young people wandering along the countrysides as mendicants begin to discover people. They find out what other people think, how they live, how they feel, and how their values rise. It's a very great and interesting experience, and it is something, an equivalent to which, would be very useful here. That the individual graduating with skill from one of our institutions would have a pilgrimage of a year of dedication, or would be required to go out and practice his skill in some foreign field or some level of society where he will serve others without compensation. I think after that he might have an entirely different viewpoint on life. Most of those who have gone out in various ways, in Peace Corps work and so forth, have been considerably influenced by what they have seen and have come to realize more of the real problems of humanity. problems that we carefully conceal from ourselves and from each other. So the Buddhist attitude, as the Zen man, has this quietude in it, not to become rich or great, but to become better. And if there is a native talent, as ML may be, that this talent should be used for the common good of mankind. Out of this, the workman is worthy of his hire. But the concept of vast accumulations under the name of success must be left behind. The real success is the individual whose usefulness is great and who is able to contribute strongly to the well-being of others. 1 year ago, there was a little story told, it's kind of cute. In Buddhist temples in Japan, including the Zen temples, there are very wide eaves and beautiful tiles and so forth. And these temple walls and ceilings on the outside, the roofs, become the proper places for birds to gather. And they come by thousands, and the old monks feed them and take good care of them, for the first veterinary hospitals in the world were managed by Buddhists. A tourist comes in and sees these birds up there, looks down around and says, "My, those birds are messy. They're messing up the whole place." And the old Buddhist monk says, "They're not messy. They're not messy. They are very, very lovely and beautiful. We take care of them. And if there's any mess, we know more than they do, so we clean it up." And this is more or less the attitude that you have among these people. And it's a good attitude. It's an attitude that shows that there is a level of society which is not self-centered. There is a part of human nature that will not be denied the experience of the presence of a divine power. In every society, atheistic or heathen, so-called, there are those that have no philosophy of religion. There are some who set themselves aside automatically for some type of charity, for some good work, for something to help other people. And these are the ones who come the nearest to the good life and also are the ones most likely to be remembered in history. History does not record nearly as much information about the materially successful as about those mentally, morally, spiritually, and ethically successful. Those who have lived above the corruptions of their times. In our own little way, in our own daily living and so forth, we can begin to try, not desperately, but sincerely, to carry on a better disciplined attitude toward life. We can discipline our entertainment programs and simply not attend things that we know are not good. We can discipline our reading to books that are inspiring and helpful, and get out of the great international publication field of scandal and gossip. We can get away from all kinds of infirmities of relationship. We can restore broken friendships. We can make new friends. We can try to be useful to people around us who are obviously in need. And little by little, we can find a life of harmlessness, a life which, in the long run, makes us no poorer than we would have been before, but richer in memories of beauty and memories of charity and love and friendship. These are the things that really count, because it is only the memory of what is done that we can take with us when we go. None of the things we have added up can be go. They all have to stay behind for another generation to pore over in one way or another. But that which is in the soul of us is a deeper memory. Behind the memory of the mind, there is a universal memory in all of us. And that universal memory is the continuity of the soul, which goes on from life to life, helping us to grow. For all embodiments are merely days and nights of one life. And we are going to school one day, and then another day, and then another day. But the soul power itself is the long, vast computerization of everything that we have done since we existed as individuals. And little by little, this information becomes available to us, not by the perpetuation of incidents, but by pressures within ourselves, feelings, convictions, hopes, beliefs, ideals, arise from some deeper source than from within our mental structure. The mind is only aware of this life, but the soul and the heart are part of our entire pattern of universal existence. That which we feel within ourselves as a great impulse to kindness, charity, thoughtfulness, and virtue, these are the testimonies to long-experienced lessons. They have been ours for a long time, and we will continue to build them. But always we must realize that the primary purpose is that the individual shall simplify his life, that he shall gradually reach the point where he cannot continue to live entirely from the outside. There is a point in which the life tips from externals to internals. The individual who has very little enlightenment is completely under the pressure of the things around him and the persons who can influence him. As he gets wiser and wiser, the process is changed. Little bit by bit, the leadership comes from the inside and not from the opinions of other people. The principles in the heart and mind take strength, and the fallacies of our present physical systems become apparent. It's an amazing thing, it seems to me, that with science as far advanced as it is in many things, that it seems to remain completely unaware of anything not physical. It just cannot transcend the physical patterns of things. The scientist might like to view the universe as a vast computerizing mechanism, but he will not put any operator behind it. He will insist that the machine works itself. And a computer working itself will soon disillusion anyone who tries it, because it cannot be done. The great mystery in life is how these things can happen, how this infinite diversity of human relationships, the infinite diversity of stars, constellations, the vast distances of time and space, and the number of tiny little cells that are found in the stalk of a plant, everything perfect, everything exactly as it ought to be, everything showing the highest skill of creativity that is imaginable, everything obviously bearing witness to a supreme intelligence that never contradicts itself, that never goes against its own rules, but is forever trying to bring living things into harmony with life itself. How science can face this and not see anything is very difficult to understand. The reason has to be very simple. The mental coordinator has taken over. It has done it to the degree that the mind has become and is remaining the slayer of the real. There has to be something to break through this boundary, to get over this insistence that the mind is the highest power in man. It is not. There is much above the power of the mind, but the most immediately available is the power of the heart. Above that, the evidence of a soul long conditioned in existences. These things are the real basis of strength, the basis of securities. Some way in this turn for something better, we must be able to remember the story in the advertisements from Parnassus by the Italian satirist Trajano Boccolini. The gods, seeing that men were in a terrible condition, decided to elect a committee to go down and find out what was wrong and do something about it. So the committee of sages and scholars went down to see what they could do about humanity. And all they had were ideas of one kind or another, that some thought there should be a window put in the human chest so that everyone could read a person's heart and find out what he really felt. But this was a rather inconvenient and somewhat curious anatomically, so this was rejected. And so on it went and on until everything was rejected. And finally, in order to have a report to give to the waiting world, the committee elected a member to get up and say that they had made the great reform of all times. They had regulated the price of cabbage. And this is what we do. And because of this very wise and naturally certain thought, Boccalini was strangled in his bed. Because people didn't want to hear that. They wanted to hear that everything was just wonderful, in spite of the fact that nothing seems to be too wonderful at the moment. But in effort to solve problems, we go through everything you can think of that will not disturb our materialistic focus. We do not want to move from a competitive to a cooperative basis in life. We want to have the possibility of being great successes, even though most of us have to remain less successful, on the hope that if one person can become wealthy, thousands refuse to accept a better way of life and thought. All this adds up to the very simple problem that the mind must be re-educated. It is a job that usually has to take place after the individual graduates from school, because there's nothing in the schooling that's going to help him much to do it. The only thing a schooling can do is to give a certain orderliness. It can make a person disciplined to learn certain things. From the discipline, perhaps, that he has gained in 12 or 15 years of education, the individual can begin to discipline himself, can begin to sense the need to clear up his own confusions. And if necessary, to make the thing as simple as possible, he can begin keeping records of his own conflicts and contradictions. He can write down his decision on a matter of a certain day and read it 6 months later and see whether his decision was really a good one. I know an individual who has been wrong in a number of details for over a period of years, but they have yet to admit that they ever made a mistake. And when the mistake hits them in the face, they have some evasion to turn it off so that it doesn't interfere with their personal estimation of infallibility. This is the way we all go. But out of this, we have to come, finally, to the realization that the inner life must lead the outer life, and that our lives up to now have been largely on the basis of history and the basis of records of material activities. We are thinking of ourselves as the descendants of the Romans and the Greeks and all the ancient people. We read with considerable thoughtfulness the stories of their miseries, misfortunes, and tribulations. It may occasionally dawn on us that we are having the same difficulties, but that is where it ends. There is no real vitalization. But if a person can reach a period or condition in life in which he leads his own life instead of following his mind, a great deal can be accomplished that is valuable and useful. The individual probably will have certain problems to face if he does it. He will find that growing is not easy, and that correcting mistakes is not easy. But he will also have a gradually unfolding sense of accomplishment. He will begin to have a real sense of his own significance and value in the unfolding of world affairs. So it is very useful and necessary for each person to try for this contemplative type of living. And the Zen man does it in a very, very simple way. He is very quiet. He sits down and tries to clear the mind of all the foolishness that has accumulated there. He tries to get out of his mind the pressures of politics. He has to try to correct the constant statements of those around him that everything is wrong. He has to keep on quietly contemplating the universal pattern and his own place in it, and gradually come to the realization that he is here to serve. that he is here to be of value to his fellow men. And while he may have a deeper insight into some of these things, the services he renders will be perfectly recognizable by those about him. The individual who goes out and helps people in trouble may do it from an invisible cause within themselves, but the visible effect will be seen and known by those he serves. Therefore, there is a certain evidence of the intent and of the achievement. And wherever we find a truly noble example of human effort, we see that it is a symbol of an intent within the soul itself. What comes from the soul is beautiful in terms of the soul. It may not be the ultimate beauty we all long for, but it is a beautiful act in itself, a masterpiece of mental and emotional achievement. And as we make these more and more frequently, we realize that the greatest of artists in all the world is not the painter or the sculptor, but the one who is able to internalize and manifest the great art of living itself. If we can only do these things, most of the problems that we solve will be a little better. But it's good to remember that the mind is not a leader. It is only a help in time of trouble. It is a kind of a Luciferian help also. It can get us into a lot of trouble. But if we are able to gradually convert the mind, if we can make the mind a convert of nobility, idealism, and integrity, then it can become a wonderful servant. It is a wonderful servant, but a horrible taskmaster. If we are run by the mind, we are run to destruction. But if we use the mind as an instrument, like the computer, because we have a personal consciousness regulating that machine, because it is a servant of a conscious power, then the mind is useful. But if we mistake this mind for that power and are willing to allow ourselves to be constantly deceived by our own thinking, then it is not so good. So I think that with our problems as they are, it would be a good plan for everyone who can to kind of think through this problem of trying to reform his own mind, to get his mind into a condition in which it can serve not only himself but his world, that it can make a lasting, enduring contribution to his family, to his friends, to those around him, a contribution of integrities, of unselfishness, of dedication, and of honest, straight thinking. The most difficult and valuable of all senses is common sense. And common sense is actually the machine of the six senses, coordinated. Common sense is what comes out when all that goes in is correct and is honorably recorded. Out of all the experiences of life, the final value lies in the fact that it strengthens the common sense which joins all human beings, the tremendous sensitiveness to the universal purpose and the plan to which we all belong. So if we work with these things a little bit, I think maybe we can become an operator of our own private computer and see that it doesn't bill wrong, go out of order every few minutes, and come up with some incredible conclusions because we don't use it properly. If we don't use the mind properly, it can get us into a lot of trouble. Use it well, and it can be an ever-present help. It's up to the individual to realize that he is the master of the mind, just as he is properly the ruler of his body. Well, I guess that's all for this morning.